Readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, with a show filled with brand new releases, with a very fun twist. They are all read by the author. Now, if you're a regular audiobook listener, I know you've got strong opinions. If you check out reader reviews, which I do each and every day, you'll see the vote is really split. Some folks think, who could be closer to their own words than the author? Other readers believe, leave the narration to the prose. We all know that nothing can taint enjoyment of an audio selection like a substandard, and by that I mean wince-inducing narrator. But I believe I've picked a really good crop, from statesmen to entertainers and beyond. At this time of year, the bookshelves are brimming with new titles. So let's get to it as we turn to page one of the book report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need MagicBuzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The MagicBuzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. MagicBuzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at MagicBuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@MagicBuzz.com. MagicBuzz, we're there when you can't be.
Tom Brokaw, one of America's most respected journalists, turns his attention to the challenges America faces in the new millennium, and his new book, The Time of Our Lives, offers reflections on how we can restore America's greatness. What happened to the America I thought I knew, Brokaw writes? Have we simply wandered off course, but only temporarily? Or have we allowed ourselves to be so divided that we're easy prey for hijackers who could steer us onto a path to a crash landing? I do have some thoughts, original and inspired by others, for our journey into the heart of a new century. Rooted in the values and lessons of generations past and of his own South Dakota upbringing, Brokaw weaves together inspiring stories of Americans who are making a difference with personal stories from his own family history. The result? A conversation about our country and ideas on how we can revitalize the promise of the American dream.
What I know for sure is that many feel America is adrift and the time to build the future is now. We will be judged not simply by the cacophony of those on the left and right with access to a cable system or a blog, but rather by the tangible legacy we leave behind. This immigrant nation, this destination for those looking for economic opportunity, political freedom, and the realization of dreams, has confronted great trials in the past and prevailed. We can draw on those experiences and find new ways to address the challenges that await us now. As I learned in the first decade of this new century, there are daring new ideas being tested in the laboratories of everyday life by bold and unconventional thinkers and doers. You'll hear their voices and learn their ideas in the chapters that follow. Academics tell us that centuries and decades are imperfect ways to measure the long curve of history. Perhaps, but for me, every decade of my life, beginning with the 40s, had a bold punctuation mark, so I had more than a little curiosity about what a new century might mean to us. The defining events of the first 60 years of my life were about to recede. What should we all expect next? What follows are the observations, hopes, memories, and suggestions of a child of the 20th century who had big dreams fulfilled beyond his boyhood fantasies. I am now a man of the 21st century, with some observations on how we might realize the great promise of a future that would benefit us all. It was a New Year's Eve unlike any other in my lifetime and possibly yours. On December 31, 1999, I stood on the top floor terrace of the Renaissance Hotel, high above Times Square in New York City, looking down on the revelers jammed into every square millimeter of sidewalk, curb, gutter, and street, an estimated 2 million who were giddily anticipating the beginning of a new century and a new millennium. We were part of a vast global gathering, witnessing the turn of the clock from the momentous events of the 20th century, what had been called the American century, to the unknown events of a new calendar. There was a rolling wave of euphoria about the moment and apprehension about the unknown as the clock struck midnight around the world. I was 59 years old, a long way from my heartland roots. Immersed in journalism, successful in my marriage and professional life, and a relatively new grandfather. I had reported on most of the major events of the previous four decades, from the triumphs, tragedies, and turmoil of the 60s in America, through the resignation of a U.S. president, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the emergence of China as a political and economic force, wars in the Middle East and Central America, the birth of 24-hour cable news, the still evolving and transformative effect of cyberspace, and at the time, a cheerful celebration of prosperity in ever more layers of American life. While I tried to offer our audience some perspective on what this new 21st century might bring, it was, in retrospect, a modest effort. My friend and competitor, Peter Jennings, was across the way, anchoring an impressive and much more ambitious ABC News production on the turn of the century. As he demonstrated one of the marvels of our new age, communication by satellite and via internet, which allowed him to instantly call up colleagues in China, Australia, Africa, and elsewhere, and bring the global party to his glassy studio in Midtown Manhattan. The airwaves that night were filled with commentators in every language on every medium, grasping for the phrase that might put 2,000 years in perspective and prepare their audience for the next 2,000. The biggest concern at the time was Y2K, shorthand for the year 2000. Would all the computers that formed the central nervous system of the world's financial markets, transportation systems, and communication networks, and were vital to commerce, medicine, law enforcement, and even entertainment, recognize the changeover from years beginning with 19 to 20?
That was The Time of Our Lives by Tom Brokaw. Mindy Kaling, one of my faves from The Office, is really just the girl next door. Okay, maybe not so true if you live anywhere in the continental United States, but definitely true if you live in India or Sri Lanka. Mindy has lived many lives, the obedient child of immigrant professionals, a timid chupster afraid of her own bike, a Ben Affleck impersonating off-Broadway performer and playwright, and finally, a comedy writer and actress prone to starting fights with friends with the sentence, quote, "Can I just say one last thing about this and then I swear I'll shut up," unquote. In Is Everyone Hanging Out Without Me and Other Concerns, Mindy shares what makes a great best friend or a great guy, or what is the perfect amount of fame, plus how to maintain a trim figure. Sadly, you will not find that information in these pages. But what you will find are highly entertaining musings of a talented gal in a tour of her life. These are her unscientific observations on romance, friendship, and Hollywood, with several conveniently placed stopping points for you to run errands and make phone calls.
I don't remember a time when I wasn't chubby. Like being Indian, being chubby feels like it is just part of my permanent deal. I remember being in first grade in Mrs. Gilmore's class at Fisk Elementary School and seeing that Ashley Kemp, the most popular girl in her class, weighed only 37 pounds. We knew this because we weighed her on the industrial postal scale they kept in the teacher supply closet. I was so envious. I snuck into the supply closet later that same day to weigh myself. I was a whopping 68 pounds. Some of the first math I understood was that I was closer to twice Ashley's weight than to her weight. Don't be closer to twice a friend's weight than to her actual weight, I told myself. This little mantra has helped me stave off obesity for more than 2 decades. My mom's a doctor, but because she came from India and then Africa, where childhood obesity was not a problem, she put no premium on having skinny kids. In fact, she and my dad didn't mind having a chubby daughter. Part of me wonders if it even made them feel kind of prosperous, like Have you seen our overweight Indian child? Do you know how statistically rare this is? It will then not come to you as a surprise that I've never been thin in my life, except the day I was born when I was 6 pounds. It's a small point of pride that I was a 6 pound baby, because from my limited understanding of baby weights, that's on the skinnier side. I flaunt my low baby weight the way really obese people must flaunt their dainty small feet. It's my little claim to skinny fame. From then on, it was full speed ahead food paradise. In grade school, I would vacillate along the spectrum from chubby to full-on fat until I was about 14. Being overweight is so common in America and comes in so many forms that you can't just call someone fat and have the reasonable expectation that they will understand you. So here's my breakdown. Chubby, a regular-sized person who could lose a few, for whom you feel affection. Chubster, an overweight, adorable child, that kid from Two and a Half Men for the first couple years. Fatso, an antiquated term, really. In the 1970s, mean sorority girls would call a pledge this, probably most often used on people who aren't even really fat, but who fear being fat. Fat, not usually used to describe weight, actually. This deceptive term is more a reflection of one's laziness. In the writer's room of The Office, an upper-level writer might get impatient and yell, "Eric, take your fats and those six fats and go write this B story. I don't want to hear any more excuses why the plot doesn't make any sense." Obese. A serious, non-pejorative way to describe someone who is unhealthily overweight. Obesitron. A nickname you might give someone you adore who just stepped on your foot accidentally and it hurt. Alternatively, a fat robot. Overweight. When someone is roughly 30 pounds too heavy for his or her frame. Pudgy. The same as chubby. Pudgo. The same as chubster. Jabba the Hutt. Primarily a Star Wars villain. Also, something you can call yourself after a really filling Thanksgiving dinner. Your aunts and uncles will really laugh hard at this. Tubalard. A huge compliment given by Depression-era people to other, less skinny people. Whale. A really, really mean way that teen boys target teen girls. For more on whale, listen to the following anecdote. Duante Diallo. There have been two times in my life, ages 14 and 19, when I lost a ton of weight over a short period of time. At 14, I lost the weight because of Duante Diallo. In ninth grade, my class was made up mostly of the same kids with whom I'd gone to middle school, with the exception of about 20 splashy new kids. One of these students was Duante. Duante Diallo was a handsome kid from Senegal who'd moved to Boston to play soccer for our school. He was immediately the star forward of our varsity soccer team. We had a not-great, artsy, private school-type soccer team. The kind made up of slender boys whose primary goal was to seem well-rounded for college applications. But you could tell Duante would have been the star of even a really good team. He was beloved by teachers because he was a brave kid for being so far away from his parents, and beloved by students because he was good-looking, a jock, and had an interesting African accent. Also, people couldn't believe the stuff he had done in Senegal, like smoke, drive a car, have sex, live in a village, and hold a gun. When he was introduced at a student assembly, he chose to give a short speech where he taught us a sports cheer from Senegalese soccer matches. In the hallways, small crowds would form around Duante as he shared stories from his past. Once, he shot a cow with an AK-47. He was so popular, you could barely look at him without being blinded by cool.
That was Is Everyone Hanging Out Without Me? By Mindy Kaling. On the very first Book Report show, back in October 2010, we previewed Condoleezza Rice's Extraordinary Ordinary People. Now, just off the presses, her No Higher Honor, a memoir of my years in Washington. During the 8 years she served at the highest levels of government, Rice traveled almost continuously around the globe, seeking common ground among sometimes bitter enemies and laboring to reach agreements on divisive issues. With the September 11th terrorist attacks, Rice found herself at the center of the administration's intense efforts to keep America safe. Here, Rice describes the events of that harrowing day and the tumultuous days after. Additionally, she reveals new details about the debates that led to the war in Afghanistan and then Iraq. The eyes of the nation were once again focused on Rice in 2004 when she appeared before the 9/11 Commission to answer tough questions regarding the country's preparedness for and immediate response to the 9/11 attacks. Her responses, it was generally conceded, would shape the nation's perception of the administration's competence during the crisis. Rice conveys just how pressure-filled that appearance was and her surprised gratitude when, in succeeding days, she was saluted for her grace and forthrightness.
It had been a long 2 days. On Thursday morning, September 13, 2001, I stood looking at myself in the bathroom mirror. How could this have happened? Did we miss something? Keep your focus. Just get to the end of today, then tomorrow, then the next day. There will be a time to go back. Not now. You have work to do. The time of reckoning, of facing the nation and myself about what happened that day, would come in April 2004, when I testified before the 9/11 Commission. From the day the commission was announced, I knew that the administration would be asked the questions I'd asked myself. How could you let it happen on your watch? Why didn't you see that the system was blinking red? I was familiar with past commissions of this type and had even taught about the investigations into the Roosevelt administration's failure to spot telltale signs of an impending attack on Pearl Harbor. But it's one thing to read about it and quite another to be a central, maybe the central character in the drama. Isn't it a fact, Dr. Rice, that the August PDB warned against possible attacks in this country? Some 45 minutes into my testimony, Richard Benvenista, a seasoned prosecutor, abruptly pounced. He was referring to an intelligence report prepared for the President's Daily Briefing, PDB, on August 6, 2001. The report had been developed only after the President himself had asked whether there was any information on a possible al-Qaeda attack on the U.S. homeland. The very fact that he'd had to ask suggested that the intelligence community thought it an unlikely event. The report summarized historical information that had been contained in old intelligence documents and quoted a media interview that had already been public. It also said that the intelligence community could not corroborate a 1998 report about Osama bin Laden's desire to hijack a U.S. aircraft. None of us even remembered the PDB until May 2002, when CBS Evening News referred to its contents. I had talked to Bob Woodward and his colleague Dan Egan of the Washington Post about it and had given a long White House press room briefing. The story had largely gone away. The report, though, carried the eye-popping headline, Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S. Since it had been issued only a month shy of 9/11, it commanded the spotlight during the hearings. In my opening statement before the commission, I said that the briefing item had not been prompted by any specific threat information. It noted some suspicious activity that we went to considerable lengths to investigate. But the report was not a warning, which I made clear at other points during the hearing. That did not prevent the commissioners from asking probing and at times hostile questions about its contents. I had to be careful with what I said because the report itself was still classified at the time. In fact, there are no more closely held documents than PDBs, which are seen only by the president, the vice president, and a handful of other officials. Because PDBs usually deal with the most sensitive and current intelligence reporting, they are rarely declassified. But that fact did not prevent Commissioner Benvenista from asking me to reveal the title of the August 6 memorandum. I knew I had to answer the question. I believe the title was Bin Laden Determined to Attack Inside the United States, I said. There were audible gasps in the chamber, particularly from victims' families who were in attendance. The report's title was suddenly the news of the hearings. As the president's national security advisor, I had the responsibility of managing the various agencies involved in national security affairs at the time of the attacks. It helped to remember that I'd done everything that I thought necessary at the time. From the very beginning, I pressed for a strategy to disable al-Qaeda and directed Richard Clark, the White House's counterterrorism expert, to develop one. When threat levels began to spike in the summer of 2001, we moved the U.S. government at all levels to a high state of alert. Secretary of State Colin Powell and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld had secured our embassies and military bases abroad. After all, the intelligence assessment was that an attack would most likely come in Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Israel, or in Europe.
That was No Higher Honor by Condoleezza Rice. No matter what you think of her comedy, you will agree that Ellen DeGeneres is one brave woman who has made her mark in America's cultural landscape. From her groundbreaking TV series to her wildly popular daytime talk show, Ellen keeps us entertained. When speaking about her new book, Seriously, I'm Kidding, she says, and I quote, "I've experienced a whole lot the last few years, and I have a lot to share. So I hope that you'll take a moment to sit back, relax, and enjoy the words I've put together for you in this book. I think you'll find I've left no stone unturned, no door unopened, no window unbroken, no rug unvacuumed, and no ivories untickled. What I'm saying is, let us begin, shall we?" End quote.
Over the last year or so since deciding to write this book, people have been asking me how I have the time and why I chose to write it. The truth is, last June, I was driving through a tunnel while I was on the phone with my agent, and my cell service was spotty. I said, "I just got a great IKEA table for my breakfast nook." My agent thought I said, "I've got a great idea for my newest book." By the time we figured out our hilarious misunderstanding, I had signed a whole bunch of papers. Who has time to read all those words? And I was under contract to write a book. Similarly, a few years ago, I told my agent, "I think I got some fudge on my lapel," and he thought I said, "I want to be a judge on American Idol." Since then, I got a new phone, and I found out my agent's name is Marvin, not Blarvin. But the truth is, I'm glad I decided to write this book. I love writing, and I do feel like I've learned a lot about life and love and other L words since I wrote my last book, and there are things I want to share with the world. As it turns out, writing a book is hard. It's not as hard as mining coal or teaching teenagers to drive, I know that, but it is hard. I didn't think it would be so hard because I go on television every day and I talk for an hour and I usually have plenty to say. Plus, I've already written other books, two as myself and dozens more under my pen name, Danielle Steele. When I first sat down to write, I stared at the blank page and I tried to think of some strategies for getting started. When I want a guest on my show to start talking and telling a good story, I ask him a question. So, I asked myself a question that I would ask a guest. When did you first fall in love with Tim McGraw? That didn't get me anywhere, and I quickly realized I shouldn't ask myself questions that are so specific to Faith Hill. So I asked myself a different question. What made you take on the lead role in Precious? That didn't work either. So then I began to think about you, the listeners. Who are you? What are you doing? What are you wearing? Not in a weird way. I thought it would help to put myself in your shoes for a moment. It always helps to think about other people instead of just ourselves. Like, if you want to know what I'm doing right now, I'm driving to work with my top down. The roof of my convertible is up. I'm wearing a beret. It helps me think, and it makes me feel French. That is also why I'm pretending to smoke a straw, and that is probably why a bus full of tourists is staring at me. So what would you like to hear about as my listener, I wondered. Perhaps you might like to hear about some of the highlights that have occurred throughout my life and career. But it's hard to know what highlights you would find exciting versus the highlights I think are exciting. For example, a few years ago, I called my credit card company and I got a late fee reversed that, quite honestly, I didn't think they'd reverse. That was a really big moment for me because you know how cranky some customer service representatives can be when they're having a bad day? But I don't know if that qualifies as the type of highlight you're looking to hear about. I let my mind wander through some of the biggest moments in my life, and then I realized what I needed to do. Since I don't know specific things about each and every one of you, except that a lot of you are probably brunettes, I decided to include a little something for everyone in this audiobook. You're going to hear some short stories for adults, and many things for all ages in between. You'll also hear self-help tips, some medical advice from someone who has no medical background nor the authority to dole out medical advice, nutrition facts, and you might even learn how to be happier in your everyday lives. I hope you do. Addendum. There are a few things I wanted to include in this audiobook, but decided instead to save for my memoir. The following is a list of things you will not hear about in this audiobook. Details of my long-term relationship with Javier Bardem. My years spent in juvie. My early days as a pioneer of disco. My involvement with the Milli Vanilli lip-syncing scandal of 1990. My recently discovered half-sister. The leaked sex tape.
That was Seriously, I'm Kidding by Ellen DeGeneres. In Drama, An Actor's Education, John Lithgow shares a backstage view of his own struggles, crisis, and discoveries, revealing the early life and career that took place out of the public eye. Lithgow's memoir is a tribute to his most important influence, his father, Arthur Lithgow, who, as an actor, director, producer, and great lover of Shakespeare, brought theater to John's boyhood. From bedtime stories to Arthur's illustrious productions, performance and storytelling were constant parts of family life. Drama details those moments that introduced a budding young actor to the undeniable power of theater. Before Lithgow gained fame with films like The World According to Garp and TV shows like Third Rock from the Sun, his early years were full of scenes both hilarious and bittersweet. His ruminations on the nature of theater, film acting, and storytelling cut to the heart of why actors are driven to perform and why people are driven to watch them do it.
My mother, my father, and I gradually fell into a predictable routine. I fixed their meals. I took Dad on short, halting constitutional walks. I bathed him, powdered him, and got rid of that awful rash. He'd gotten shabby and unkempt, so I trimmed his nails, shaved his stubbly beard, and cut his stringy hair. I prodded him to tell sunny stories of his early days and his young years with my mom. I coaxed him into word games and crosswords. I stumped him with scraps of Shakespearean trivia, anything. Anything to cheer him up. But nothing worked. He made listless, half-hearted attempts to indulge me and my strenuous diversions, but nothing dispelled his feelings of gloom and doom. He felt tired and forgotten. He felt his life wasted and misspent. He'd lost his will to live. Without it, he was clearly not going to last much longer. I felt as if my mother and I were helplessly monitoring the slow decline of an old man who had just given up. Then one day, halfway through my time with them, I had an idea. It was an idea that bubbled up through the soft focus haze of my childhood 50 years before. It was one of the best ideas I ever had. In my grade school years, my family moved a lot. There was an old burnt orange sofa that traveled with us everywhere we went. That humble piece of furniture figures in some of the fondest memories of my youth. It was where I first heard stories. My siblings and I would cuddle up to my father on that sofa at bedtime, and he would read to us. He read the comics in the newspaper with near religious regularity. He read Kipling's The Jungle Book, a chapter a night. He read Dickens' A Christmas Carol every year on Christmas Eve. He read doggerel poems by Edward Lear, Lewis Carroll, and Ogden Nash from a set of bright orange volumes called Childcraft. For all of us, our most intimate memories of our father, his crinkly smile, his plummy voice, his husky smell, and his short-sleeved seersucker shirts are connected to those lazy, luxurious evening hours on that scratchy wool sofa, all of us on the verge of sleep. Most memorably, he read to us from a fat book called Tellers of Tales. This was a 1,500-page tome edited by W. Somerset Maugham that contained 100 classic short stories. The book had been printed in 1939. By the 50s, our copy was already faded and worn, its pages yellowing. Its spine was sprung, too, but my father had craftily repaired it with crimson-colored duct tape. He had even taken pains to neatly write its title in white ink on the taped spine. Characteristically, he had written it upside down by mistake. When we were growing up, that homely old book was a kind of family Bible in the Lithgow household, wherever that household happened to be at the time, and Story Hour had all the gravity of a sacred rite. We would pick a story, and my father would read it, savoring the wit, ramping up the suspense, and performing all the characters full out. He worked a kind of hypnotic magic on us. We would hold our breath at the hair-raising suspense of the monkey's paw, We would sniffle and sob when Crumbambuli, the loyal Alsatian mountain dog, died of a broken heart. For the first time, we heard the words of Ernest Hemingway, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Arthur Conan Doyle, Edgar Allan Poe, Jack London, Dorothy Parker, and on and on and on. Did we have an all-time favorite? Oh, yes. It was the funny one. It was called Uncle Fred Flits By by P.G. Woodhouse. This one was something special. Over the years, I forgot most of the details of this story. Its plot and its settings all became a blur. But I remembered Pongo. I remembered the pink chap. I remembered something about a parrot. And I remembered the outrageous Uncle Fred and his crackpot schemes, especially as portrayed by my father, a man with an abundant history of crackpot schemes of his own.
That was Drama, An Actor's Education by John Lithgow. Calvin Trillin hails from Kansas City, which some have called the heart of America. I quickly learned in reading his latest book, Quite Enough of Calvin Trillin, that some had started a move to change the city motto to More Boulevards than Paris, More Fountains than Rome. Yes, Mr. Trillin does report the unusual, all part of his unique way of examining our world. Calvin attended Yale, where he served as chairman of the Yale Daily News. Next came a stint in the U.S. Army. He worked as a reporter for Time magazine, and in 1963 joined the staff of The New Yorker. His reporting for The New Yorker on racial integration of the University of Georgia was published in his first book, An Education in Georgia. He wrote the magazine's U.S. Journal from 1967 to 1982, covering local events both serious and quirky throughout the U.S. These were 3,000-word pieces every 3 weeks from somewhere in the United States on subjects that ranged from the murder of a farmer's wife in Iowa to the author's effort to write the definitive history of a Louisiana restaurant called Dee Dee's, or, quote, to eat an awful lot of baked duck and dirty rice tryin'. In 1978, Calvin began with a column in The Nation called Variations, which was eventually named Uncivil Liberties and ran through 1985. The same name, Uncivil Liberties, was used for his column when it was syndicated weekly in newspapers from 1986 to 1995. Essentially, the same column then ran without a name in Time magazine from 1996 to 2001. From the July 2, 1990 issue of The Nation to today, Trillin writes his weekly Deadline Poet column, humorous poems about current events. Trillin lives in Greenwich Village, where, according to him, people come from the suburbs on the weekends to test their car alarms. He lectures widely and is often a guest on TV talk shows. Welcome, Calvin. Thanks so much for taking time out of your schedule to speak with me today.
Well, it's nice to be here. Thank you.
I have to ask, first off, you included a piece in the book about killer bagels, and I myself have been a victim of surgery due to a bagel-related injury, so I'm wondering, were you ever wounded by a bagel?
No, I've never been wounded by a bagel. Apparently, it was a problem more in the hinterlands than in New York, where I think emergency room doctor in New York in that piece said to the Times, some of those people were not ethnically equipped to eat bagels.
Well, I'm Jewish, and I ended up in the emergency room, so go figure.
In New York, of course, bagels are considered quite benign. Their stale bagel is famous for being a good teething instrument for children and a good hockey puck for street hockey. So nobody thinks of them as dangerous, I don't think.
All right. You describe deadline poetry as a very small subset of rhyming poetry, and you formed the International Deadline Poets Organization. How did you create this very specialized version, poetry?
Well, I created the organization simply because there was another deadline poet, John Alamang of the Globe and Mail in Toronto. So we came together, and it was hard to get a quorum, but we managed, and we formed the International Deadline Poets, IDPO, we call it. And as far as how I did it, I was inspired by John Sununu, who had not only a wonderful personality for people like me, which is that he was very intent on showing he was the smartest man in the room, but also had this beautiful name, Sununu. And so while he was the chief of staff of George H.W. Bush, I wrote a poem called If You Knew What Sununu. After that, it just came kind of simply.
And recently, have there been any favorite politicos that you've been rhyming about?
Yeah, I did a poem this week about Newt Gingrich's surge. And Newt's a good rhyme. Gingrich is not too good. And last week I wrote about Kane, and all of the lines rhymed with Kane. That's fairly easy. It's a good rhyme, Kane.
How did you begin writing about food?
Well, I used to do a piece for The New Yorker every 3 weeks somewhere in the country, and most of them were about, controversies or murders or something. And at some point, I think it was the Brobridge Crawfish Festival, I realized I could write about the country in a lighter way by writing about eating, even though I don't actually know anything about it. I've never reviewed a restaurant, and I don't cook. I just found it something that everybody sort of identified with.
Did you ever make it to dinner at the Oscar de la Renta home?
I'm afraid not. No, I was never invited. I just sat by my phone for a long time.
Okay, as the holiday Christmas season shopping is almost upon us, I was wondering if you could share some of your Christmas in Qatar.
The shopping starts, and every store is a zoo. I'm frantic, too. I haven't got a clue of what to get for Dad, who's got no hobby, or why Aunt Jane, who's shaped like a kohlrabi, wants frilly sweater sets, or where I'll find a tie my loudmouth Uncle Jack won't mind. A shopper's told it's vital he prevails. Prosperity depends on Christmas sales. Can't stop to talk, I say. No time. Can't halt. Economy could fail. Would be my fault. And the chorus is, I'd like to spend some next Christmas in Qatar or someplace else that Santa won't find handy. Qatar will do, although Lord knows it's sandy. I need to get someplace to get to someplace pretty far. I'd like to spend next Christmas in Qatar.
Well, I know that you're on a very exhaustive book tour right now, but what projects are upcoming?
Well, I just closed a New Yorker piece on for the food issue that's actually about the limits of my cooking in Nova Scotia, where I live in the summer, from 3 to 8 dishes, depending on how you count.
Thank you so much for spending some moments with us today.
Thank you.
In Calvin Trillin's Antic Tales of Family Life, Alice was portrayed as the wife who had a weird predilection for limiting our family to 3 meals a day. Though his book deals with her loss, About Alice is also a love story, chronicling a romance that began at a Manhattan party in December of 1963. Let's listen to a bit, performed by Calvin himself.
I once wrote that tales about writers' families tend to have a relation to real life that can be expressed in terms of standard network television fare, on a spectrum that goes from sitcoms to Lifetime movies, and that mine were sitcoms. Now that I think of it, maybe they were more like the Saturday morning cartoons. Alice played the role of the mom, the voice of reason, the sensible person who kept everything on an even keel despite the antics of her marginally goofy husband. Years ago, at a conference of English teachers where we were both speakers, the professor who did the introduction said something like, Alice and Bud are like Burns and Allen, except she's George and he's Gracie. Yes, of course, the role she played in my stories was based on the role she played in our family. Our daughters and I sometimes called her TM, which stood for the mother. But she didn't play it in the broad strokes of a sitcom mom. Also, she was never completely comfortable as the person who takes responsibility for keeping things on an even keel. That person inevitably misses out on some of the fun. I feel the need to break out of the role of straight person, she said, in a Nation review of Alice Let's Eat, that cautioned readers against abandoning long-planned European vacations in order to scour the country for the perfect roast polecat haunch. The sitcom presentation sometimes made her sound stern as well as wise, and she was anything but stern. She had something close to a child's sense of wonderment. She was the only adult I ever knew who might respond to encountering a deer on a forest path by saying, "Wowzers." Once, during a question-and-answer period that followed a speech I had given at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco, someone asked how Alice felt about the way she was portrayed in my books and articles. I said that she thought the portrayal made her sound like what she called a dietitian in sensible shoes. Then the same questioner asked if Alice was in the audience, and when I said she was, he asked if she'd mind standing up. Alice stood. As usual, she looked smashing. She didn't say anything. She just leaned over and took off one of her shoes, shoes that looked like they cost about the amount of money required in some places to tide a family of four over for a year or two, and, smiling, waved it in the air. She wasn't a dietitian in sensible shoes, and she would have been right in saying that the people whose exposure to her had been through my stories didn't know her. Still, in the weeks after she died, I was touched by their letters. They may not have known her, but they knew how I felt about her. It surprised me that they had managed to divine that from reading stories that were essentially sitcoms. Even after I'd taken in most episodes of The Honeymooners, after all, it had never occurred to me to ponder the feelings Ralph Cramden must have had for Alice Cramden. Yet I got a lot of letters like the one from a young woman in New York who wrote that she sometimes looked at her boyfriend and thought, "But will he love me like Calvin loves Alice?" The letter that made me laugh was from Roger Wilkins. By the time of Alice's death, Roger occupied a chair of history and American culture at George Mason University, but in the 70s he had been on the editorial board of the New York Times. In that period, I'd sometimes joined the regular lunches he had with the late Richard Harris, a remarkable investigative reporter for The New Yorker, who had the aggressively unsentimental worldview often found among people in his line of work. Alice and Roger became acquainted when she accompanied me to a conference I was covering in New Orleans. In off hours, when we'd gather around the hotel swimming pool, she and Roger sometimes had long, serious conversations. It wasn't unusual for me to find Alice having long, serious conversations with people I'd been bantering with for years. She got engaged with people's lives. If she said to a friend's son or daughter, "How's school?" she wasn't just being polite. She wanted details, and she wasn't shy about offering advice. If people we were visiting mentioned that they'd been thinking about renovating their house, Alice was right on the case, room by room. In such architectural conversations, she could get bossy, and sometimes I felt obliged to warn our hosts that one of her characteristic gestures, the gesture she used when she was saying something like, "You have to open all of this up," was remarkably similar to the gesture you'd use to toss money into the wind. She wasn't among those whose response to tragedy or loss was limited to offering the conventional expressions of sympathy before moving on with their own lives. In 1988, an old friend phoned us to say that his grown daughter, a young woman we'd known since she was a child, had been raped by an intruder. This was a dozen years after Alice had been operated on for lung cancer. And among the things that she wrote to our friend's daughter was that having lung cancer and being raped were comparable only in that both were what she called realizations of our worst nightmares.
That was About Alice by Calvin Trillin. Infused with Carrie Fisher's trademark incisive wit and perfectly poised on the heels of Wishful Drinking, the New York Times bestseller, Shockaholic takes listeners on another rollicking ride. Told with the same style and honesty, Shockaholic is the juicy account of Carrie Fisher's life, focusing more on the Star Wars years and dishing about the various Hollywood relationships she's formed since she was chosen to play Princess Leia at an impossibly young 19 years old. Fisher delves into the gritty details that made the movie and herself such a phenomenal success, admitting, "It isn't all sweetness and lightsabers."
I was so completely fascinated and charmed by what she wrote that by the last page, I had completely forgotten that she was an over-the-Beverly Hill mediocre actress with a wrinkly neck and unsightly upper arms. And probably the most important thing I came away with is that I now have the ability to forgive myself for all those judgmental, hateful, preconceived notions that I harbored for a well-meaning person who was only trying to make me take a good, long, hard look at myself by sharing her story with me. After which I said, wow, I now realize for the first time that I need to love and respect others before I can truly love myself. And by others, for the most part, I mean Carrie Fisher. From Shockaholic, I learned that a person doesn't have to finish high school to have insight and use big words. Miss Fisher may not be what is considered conventionally attractive. Among other things, her teeth are so big that they'd have to add letters to the alphabet in order to identify her bra size. But it's my opinion that you couldn't find a better example of good people in all of history. And you've got to respect someone who's managed to overcome the previously unappreciated challenges of growing up surrounded by an unending procession of maids and governesses and cooks and guards, depriving her of the joys of being raised by a mother and father in a cozy house in a regular neighborhood with a dog and home-cooked meals and chores. This is a person who missed out on the ordinary, everyday essentials most people can count on as a foundation from which a sane, predictable life can be built, and who had to forge an existence for herself that made up for never having known the joy of saying, "What's for dinner, Mom?" or "No, I did not flush the fish down the toilet." Instead, Miss Fisher had to develop values in the face of the hard reality of wanting for nothing. Sure, from the outside, her life looked too good to be real. But if you think about it very briefly, I think you'll come to the conclusion that perhaps it was too unreal to be good.
That was Shockaholic by Carrie Fisher. Dexter Morgan is not your average serial killer. He enjoys his day job as a blood spatter analyst for the Miami Police Department. But at night, he lives for his hobby of hunting killers. Dexter is therefore not pleased to discover that someone is shadowing him, observing him, and copying his methods. Dexter is not one to tolerate displeasure. In fact, he has a knack for extricating himself from trouble in his own pleasurable way. Like the previous five best-selling novels in the Dexter series, Double Dexter showcases the witty, macabre originality that has propelled Jeff Lindsay to international success. Double Dexter is raucously entertaining, full of smart suspense and dark laughs.
There is sudden silence, a complete hush, as if nothing anywhere is breathing and even the darkness is holding its breath. And then there comes a sudden rush of wind and a last hammer of thunder, and the whole world cries out, "Now! Now!" And all that must happen in this dark summer night begins to happen. The skies open up and let go of their burden. The world begins to breathe again, and here in the newly wet darkness, other tensions flex and uncoil so very slowly, carefully, reaching their soft, sharp tendrils out toward the fumbling, clown-like figure now scrabbling to unlock his car in this sudden rain. The car's door swings open, the laptop and folder thump onto the seat, and then the soft and doughy man slides in behind the wheel, slams the door, and takes a deep breath as he wipes the water from his face. And he smiles, a smile of small triumph, something he does a lot these days. Steve Valentine is a happy man. Things have gone his way a lot lately, and he thinks they have gone his way again tonight. For Steve Valentine, life is very good. It is also almost over. Steve Valentine is a clown. Not a buffoon, not a happy caricature of inept normality. He is a real clown who runs ads in the local papers and hires out for children's parties. Unfortunately, it is not the bright laughter of childish innocence that he lives for, and his sleight of hand has gotten somewhat out of hand. He has been arrested and released twice, when parents pointed out to the police that you don't really need to take a child into a dark closet to show him balloon animals. They had to let him go both times for lack of evidence. But Valentine took the hint. From that point on, nobody has complained. How could they? But he has not stopped entertaining the children. Certainly not. Leopards do not change their spots, and Valentine has not changed his. He just got wiser, darker, as wounded predators do. He has moved on into a more permanent game, and he thinks he has found a way to play and never pay. He is wrong. Tonight the bill comes due. Valentine lives in a rundown apartment building just north of Opa-locka Airport. The building looks at least 50 years old. Abandoned cars litter the street in front, some of them burned out. The building shakes slightly when corporate jets fly low overhead, landing or taking off, and that sound interrupts the constant white noise of traffic on the nearby expressway. Valentine's apartment is on the second floor, number 11, and it has a very good view of a rotting playground with a rusting jungle gym, a tilting slide, and a basketball hoop with no net. Valentine has put a battered lawn chair on the balcony of his apartment, placed so he has a perfect view of the playground. He can sit and sip a beer and watch the children play and think his happy thoughts about playing with them. And he does. He has played with at least three young boys that we know about, probably more. In the last year and a half, small bodies have been pulled from a nearby canal on three occasions. They had been sexually abused and then strangled. The boys were all from this neighborhood, which means that their parents are poor and probably in this country illegally. That means that even when their children were killed, they had very little to say to the police. And that makes their children perfect targets for Valentine. Three times, at least, and the police have no leads. But we do. We have more than a lead. We know. Steve Valentine watched those little boys at their games on the playground. And then he followed them away into the dusk and taught them his own very final games. And then he put them into the murky, trash-filled water of the canal. And he went satisfied back to his decrepit lawn chair, opened a beer, and watched the playground for a new little friend. Valentine thought he was very clever. He thought he had learned his lesson and found a better way to live out his dreams and make a home for his alternative lifestyle, and there was nobody smart enough to catch him and make him stop. Until now, he has been right. Until tonight.
That was Double Dexter by Jeff Lindsay. Who doesn't love William Shatner? Admire his many and varied talents. Appreciate his creativity and willingness to take risks. From Captain Kirk to travel site huckster, he is certainly an original whose career has boldly gone where no man has gone before. In Shatner Rules, your key to understanding the Shatnerverse and the world at large, the Captain, along with Chris Reagan, presents a hilarious collection of rules, illustrated with stories from Bill's illustrious life and career, and shows you how Bill became William Shatner, larger than life and bigger than any role he ever played. Shatner Rules is your guide to becoming Shatneresque.
Rule: always be yourself, especially if yourself has a high Q rating and is pleasing to a wide variety of advertisers. See Shatner, William. It's important for an actor to avoid typecasting. At one time, I was in danger of forever being linked to a science fiction program that had a fairly brief network run in the 1960s, but fears of typecasting aside, I've had a much easier time embracing this William Shatner character. After all, William Shatner's a role I was born to play, and this Shatner guy has become more and more popular over the years. Heck, you're even listening to a book written by him. Obviously, William Shatner has found a place in your life. In some respects, he may become inescapable. It's only a matter of time before he got roasted. Now, what did I know of roasts? Well, Dean Martin used to host them on TV in the 1970s. They were gentle, slightly ribald affairs in which celebrities in ruffled tuxedos would be ribbed by such comedic masters as Don Rickles, Phyllis Dillard, Foster Brooks, and the like. Dean would sit off on the side sipping iced tea that was supposed to resemble scotch and laugh his head off. My roast would be different. As anyone who's ever watched a Comedy Central roast can tell you, no fake booze is allowed on stage. The real stuff flows freely, to both loosen the tongue of the roasters and to ease the pain of the roastee. Fun Fechner, Andy Dick, has appeared in two Comedy Central roasts, and he has no recollection of this. And even though I'd been warned away by more people than just Leonard, I said yes to these comedy inquisitors who were about to strap me to the laugh rack on national television. Was I afraid? Of course. But I always bolster myself when embarking on a risky career endeavor by simply repeating my old actor's adage, only stuntmen get hurt. Why did I say yes? Well, I nearly always say yes. Yes means opportunity. Yes makes the dots in your life appear. And if you're willing and open, you can connect those dots. You don't know where those dots are going to lead. And if you don't invest yourself fully, the dots won't connect. The lines you make with those dots always lead to interesting places. No closes doors. Yes kicks them wide open. Rule. No means no. Has that been taken? I seriously considered saying no to being on Boston Legal. I didn't want to be involved in a serious grind. Yes earned me two Emmys. I once said yes to Decca Records when they approached me about doing an album in 1968. The Transformed Man earned itself many a no from critics, but that album has led to so many wonderful things in my life, working with Ben Folds, releasing the critically acclaimed Has-Been in 2004, and racking up millions of YouTube hits for my rendition of CeeLo's You on Lopez Tonight, and saying yes to performing You got me a very nice fan letter from CeeLo. No, please, the pleasure was all mine, Mr. Lowe. If I spent more of my life saying no, this autobiographical audiobook would be a short one indeed. But enough of the touchy-feely stuff. Let's talk about my and my weight and my hair and my acting and my weight and my hair. Did I mention my acting? All these things were fair game for my roasters, all of who were aided and abetted by a crack team of joke writers, men I quickly realized were not my friends. These writers, a bunch of schlubby guys in flannel shirts, dropped by my office for a pre-production meeting one day, and before long, I realized that they were giving me the once-over, observing my every move, listening to everything I said, piling up ammo to use against me, and trying to figure out ways to get me on a horse. I was in the hands of madmen, guys who would do anything for a laugh. The roast started with me riding through the audience on horseback, riding a horse into a roaring crowd. Have you ever ridden a horse into a 5-star hotel in front of throngs of cheering and jeering people? It's a thrilling experience, especially if you somehow manage to survive it. The horse could have gotten spooked and thrown me at any moment. If anyone should kill at a roast, it should be a comedian, not a frightened horse. Now, I love horses immensely, but I never thought I'd be riding one to my own televised execution. Either way, the show began. I survived the ride, and I successfully maneuvered the animal to the stage to thunderous applause, and even though she didn't dump any manure into the audience, plenty was about to be dumped on me at my seat on the dais.
That was Shatner Rules by William Shatner. Readers, I can't believe it's time to mention, gulp, holiday shopping. Scary! But there's plenty here to keep you out of the stores this weekend. If you're thinking of ideas not in this genre, check out my website, bookreportradio.com, for tons of recent titles the bookosphere is buzzing about. Thanks so much for joining me today. See you next week on The Book Report.